Welcome to On Mic with Jordan Rich. It's a podcast for and about voiceover artists, actors, producers, radio and TV broadcasters, performers of all kinds, anyone interested in the most fascinating of instruments, the human voice. Now, I've known my next guest for over 30 years. He's one of the sweetest guys in radio and has earned a reputation as a very fine performer with a computer-like memory. His name is Ken Meyer, member of the Massachusetts Broadcast Hall of Fame. Now, Ken's been blind since birth. He's always, though, had a passion for radio, first as a listener, then as a professional. You'll hear him talk about his interesting career and life. He's still hosting radio shows on the web. Ken, it's so nice to welcome you to my podcast. How are you, my friend?
I'm fine, Jordan. Couldn't be better.
I was just a guest on your radio show. Tell us about that.
Well, I do a show for the city of Boston, which is on a low-power station, which can be heard on the internet, and it's WBCA. And it's 102.9 FM, and it's strictly on a volunteer basis, but I love it because I can do what I want with who I want, and it's great. I had an announcer tell me once many years ago, he said, if you really love radio, it's in your blood. And I have been fascinated with radio since, believe it or not, the third grade in school. And I've loved it ever since. And, of course, being in it made it all the more. I hate to use this analogy, but it's almost like a drug. You love it that much.
Well, you have done so many great things with your career. And I'm thrilled that you're still on the air, still getting it done, as they say, and still interviewing people. But I want to take you back a little bit to those early days when you were a kid. You've been such a proponent of the golden age of radio. Were you listening then to some of those shows, or are you old enough to remember them when they were on?
Oh, no. Luckily, old radio was still going on. The last old-time radio shows that were aired were in September of 1962. I was born in 46, so I still got in on the tail end of old-time radio. It wasn't as big as it was in the 40s, but I still got in on some of the soap operas and things like The Lone Ranger and Gunsmoke and Jack Benny and Armis Brooks and shows like that. So I was still able to soak up, as it were, that age of radio. So I was very lucky.
Kenny Meyer's here, and of course, you've spent so much time in the Boston area, but you grew up in Rochester, New York, and that's where you got your start. Who were you listening to locally back then?
There were a few people. There was a great guy named Eddie Meath who worked for the CBS radio affiliate.
I didn't know
Rochester.
You had a lisp, Kenny. Eddie Meath? Oh, Meath.
Yeah.
I get it.
He did a show in the morning called The Musical Clock. The theme of which, by the way, was The Syncopated Clock by Leroy Anderson. And he was the first personality I ever met. There was a Lions Club dinner in Rochester one Saturday night, and it was the start of his idea of, he called it the Penny Fund. And he encouraged people to contribute pennies to raise money to buy toys for kids in hospitals. And I talked my mom into going. My dad didn't want to go. But my mom and I went, and he was the first personality I ever met that was in radio. And the other one was a man who should be a saint, if he isn't already. I had a love affair with a radio station called WHAM, which in Rochester is as big as WBZ as far as power and prestige is concerned. He was the both program and sports director of WHAM. He came from Elmira, New York. He had worked in Philadelphia and in Boston. And he came to Rochester in 1962 when sportscasts were 15 minutes long on radio stations. 15 minutes
Imagine
for a sportscast.
What was his name?
His name was Bill Givens.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Bill Givens. And through a friend of ours who was an usher at the Rochester Red Wing baseball park, Bill and I got acquainted. My mother drove me down to WHAM in 1965 in the summer, and for whatever reason, Bill and I just hit it off. He was an incredible talent. In fact, I believe there's a book out called The Big Bands by George T. Simon.
Oh, yes, yes. It's considered the Bible of the big band era.
And Bill is in it.
Yes.
Bill is in it.
Well, there are so many. We could spend all this time talking just about the good old days of Rochester because, like a lot of radio markets, they're the local radio legends that you grew up with and get to know. But I really want to talk about some of the other big names that people around the world will know that you've had an opportunity to meet, interview, and work with. Let's take it up a notch to when you came to Boston and studied radio and so forth. And how did you arrive at WBZ, which is my stomping grounds as well? How did you get there?
I couldn't find a job anywhere. I looked around in Rochester and the surrounding area, and I had an instructor who worked for the CBS O&O, which at that time was WEEI. And he was my instructor in our Radio 1 class, and he's still a friend. In fact, he was at our wedding and proposed and did one of the two toasts that were done before our dinner. His name was Dick Walsh. So my parents and I came to Boston in July of 1970 on a combination business trip and vacation because I wasn't getting anywhere and we didn't know what to do. So Dick Walsh said to me, look, I still, you know, I had you as a student. I know you can make it in this business. So he called Milton Graham, who was the president of Graham Junior College, where I went to school. And it just so happened that one of the trustees of Graham Junior College, a real nice gentleman named Lamont Thompson, was working also at WBZ as kind of a public relations man. Mm-hmm. So Milton Graham arranged for me to go meet Lamont Thompson at WBZ. So we sat down and we talked, and he asked me all kinds of questions. You know, what did you do in college? What makes you think you can succeed? And after we got finished, he said, is there anyone in particular you would love to meet? And I said, yeah, I'd like to meet Guy Manilla.
Who, by the way, for those who are from outside the area, did a talk show on WBZ, one of the early sports talk shows. And you and I both consider him one of the great deans of sports talk radio.
No question about it.
Right.
So I met with Guy Manilla, who was very nice. I was very excited because he was one of my heroes. And he said to me, would you like to meet our program director? And I said, yeah. So he took me across the hall and introduced me to a gentleman named Bill Schubert. One thing led to another, and it turned out that he and Dick Walsh, my instructor at Graham, used to work together at WEEI. So Bill picked up the phone and called Dick Walsh at Graham Junior College and talked to him for about half an hour. And he put down the phone and he said, Kenny, if you could do half the stuff that Dick Walsh says you can, I would hire you tomorrow. And he used a phrase that I'm sure you've never heard before. He said, but we don't have any room in our budget.
Oh, yes. Yes. Probably the most often heard words in a radio hallway.
Exactly. But he said, you know, I would love to have you here, but I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that, because Bill and I kept in contact, and they decided that Larry Glick needed a producer. Larry Glick was on all night.
It was the late night Commander Glick from midnight to 6 or so?
Yep. Right. Then it went to 5:30, and then it went to 5 o'clock. But Larry used to make phone calls on the air. I mean, you would hear him pick up the phone, dial the phone number, and people would pick up the phone at 2 in the morning, and you would hear this very pleasant voice say, hi, this is Larry Glick. We're on the air now on radio station WBZ in Boston. Well, somebody got angry and threatened to sue Glick and BZ for invasion of privacy for calling him up at 3 in the morning.
Can't say I blame them.
So it was then that they decided that Larry needed a producer, and they figured I was the one that could do it.
And let's stop right there for a second, because one of the goals of the podcast here is to not only entertain, which it is with you here, but also to inform. What is the producer in 1970 jargon doing for Larry Glick?
Scheduling calls, basically. Mm-hmm. Larry would either tell me who he wanted to get, or callers would call up with somebody interesting, and we would track them down. And I've got plenty of stories.
Well, you were there, though, during the show airing.
Yes.
So you were there
absolutely.
All night long.
I was there all night long.
Right, right.
Yep.
You were then soon to get on mic yourself.
Yes.
And tell us about that.
Well, the first time I ever went on the air, Larry Glick overslept. he went out to dinner and drank a little too much wine and got up late and overslept, didn't get in until 2 in the morning. And I went on the – I had to go on the air at midnight.
I'm sure you just hated every moment of it.
Oh, every minute of it. I was counting the minutes until Glick showed up.
Yes, yes.
But I learned a valuable lesson that night, and that lesson was you have to be yourself. You cannot imitate another talent. And I did that for a little while. You know, Larry used to give a round of applause to callers, and, you know, he had sayings like ask me anything and I'll give you an answer and all that kind of thing. And right. I did that. And then I finally decided, look, that's not me. So I just decided I would be myself.
One of the things that people remember fondly about you doing the weekend show on your own, and you got your own slot to do your own program, was your interview skills. And you had some amazing guests over the years, Kenny.
I did, and I was very lucky, and I'll just tell you, I'll tell you one story. The station moved Larry Glick from 8 to midnight, which caused considerable anguish among callers that could only pick him up after 12 o'clock. But one of the advantages to it was that we could have guests in the studio that might not have wanted to come in at midnight. Right. But had no problem doing it at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And one of the first people that we had was Vince Bugliosi, the gentleman who was the prosecutor in the Helter Skelter case.
Vincent Bugliosi, yes, I remember interviewing him as well. A fascinating guy, since passed away, I believe. But tell me about him.
Well, he had written a book called Till Death Do Us Part. And, of course, I was thrilled to death to meet this gentleman because I had read Helter Skelter. And I walked him down from the lobby to the studio, and we had a real nice chat. And he got on the air with Larry. And after he got finished, I walked him out to the lobby. And he said to me, he said, Larry really didn't read that book, did he? And I said, well, if you're putting me on the witness stand, sir, the answer is no. But I said to him, my dad is reading this book for me on tape right now. Mm. And he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I don't care how long it takes. He said, when you get the book read, you call my publicist at Bantam Books, and I'll do your interview. I'll do an interview with you on the air, no matter how long it takes you to get the book read. I said, okay. So, of course, I told my dad that, and he speeded up the reading process. And a month later, I had Vince Bugliosi on the air for an hour on BZ Radio. He came back later on. He had published a novel. And I got my picture taken with him, and we shook hands, and he said to me, you know what? I think you're one of the best interviewers in the country. Wow. And this is coming from Vincent Bugliosi. And that's just one story,
well,
and one guest that we had.
I want to do some name-dropping with you because obviously you and I share a love for the classic performers of yesteryear and some of the radio stars and TV stars from the golden age. And, I mean, you've met and interviewed quite a few the likes of Milton Berle, Danny Thomas. I mean, a lot of big names. Just a story or two from that era.
There was one night when I was in the lobby waiting for a cab, and a lady came up to me and said, do you work here? And I said, yeah. And she said, what do you do? And I told her. And I knew that voice from somewhere, but I didn't know where. And finally I said to her, listen, I apologize. I said, I know that I should know who you are, and I don't. So would you please tell me who you are? And she said, I'm Marlo Thomas.
Oh.
And I said, that's exactly what I said.
By Jove.
By Jove.
That girl.
My God.
That
exactly.
Girl.
I said, you're that girl?
That girl.
And all I could think to say was, I loved your father. And I did. I adored Danny Thomas. Saw him perform in Rochester after I had gotten out of college. There was another time when BZ Radio celebrated their 50th anniversary in 1971 on the Jerry Williams program, which was on 8 to midnight. And every night for a week, from 8 to midnight, each half hour, we had guests from old-time radio. You name them, Bob Hope, Kenny Delmar, the announcer for Allen's Alley, Howard K. Smith, the newsman from ABC, Gail Gordon, if they were alive and breathing, we had. One of the people that we had was Art Linkletter.
Oh.
A gem and a gentleman who hosted two radio programs, People Are Funny and Art Linkletter's House Party.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was in the radio station and somebody said to me, hey, Art Linkletter is over at BZTV. Well, that was all I needed. So I went over to BZTV and introduced myself. And I said, listen, have you got 10 or 15 minutes to come over to the radio side and tape an interview? And he said, listen, if we haven't got time, we'll make time. So we got up, we walked out of the studio. A friend of mine told me later they didn't know who looked happier walking down the hall, Linkletter or me.
It's one of your trademarks, your enthusiasm. We'll be right back to the program in just a moment. I did want to take time to thank you for listening to On Mic with me, Jordan Rich. You'll find links to my website and Facebook page in the show notes. So I invite you to reach out to me. I'd love to hear your ideas for future shows and guests. Since I've heard you take requests, here's one from me. When you get a moment, I'd love for you to rate and review this podcast in all of the important places we hang out, including Apple, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. It'll go a long way in helping me build this audience up and keep the studio humming with interesting content. And now, back to On Mic with Jordan Rich. Hey, that's me. Kenny Meyer and I have known each other for well over 30 years, and you know, when doing shows with you and recounting some of these stories in the past, I've always remarked on the expression on your face, which is just beaming from ear to ear. When you did another show in another radio station, WEEI, I believe, mm-hmm. on the old-time radio classics,
yep.
that's where you featured actual programs, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And that was what years were those shows aired?
I left BZ in 1985 and worked at EEI twice. I went from BZ to EEI and lasted a couple of years. Then they decided they didn't want me, and I got let go. And then they called me and said, look, we want you to come back. You know, our ratings are horrible. We need you to come back and do Radio Classics. And, of course, I did. The second time when I got let go, I knew that, you know, this was it. I wasn't going to be back.
Radio Classics is an important term in terms of you and me and performing, because for well over 20 years, Kenny and I and many other local people shared the stage with some radio golden age professionals at Massasoit Community College, now Massasoit College, right?
Right.
And that was a blast, recreating the old shows. And for people who don't know, that's the way they did them, in front of a live audience.
Exactly, exactly.
Many
shows
times.
Like Jack Benny, You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. Many of the comedy shows, or almost all of them, were done in front of a live audience. And I had a ball doing it, because we got to meet people like Gail Storm, who was in Oh, Susanna.
Of course. And Parley Bear.
Parley Bear, yes, who was Chester in Gunsmoke. wonderful, wonderful man. I had breakfast with Parley
Bear. He was a nice man. You know who else was great? William Shallert, who was Patty Duke's father and a gazillion other character roles on TV and movies.
Oh, he was wonderful.
What a gentleman. And also Betsy Palmer.
Yes, who was on I Got a Secret.
Mm-hmm.
A panelist on I Got a Secret,
and
she was in Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th. So many interesting people, and of course, that era, because of time, many of these people are gone now, but it was a thrill to work with them.
Oh, absolutely. I just couldn't believe it. You know, I mean, I'm talking to Betsy Palmer, you know, and we talk about Gary Moore and the other people on I Got a Secret, like Henry Morgan and Bess Meyerson and all this. And I just had a ball, because I used to watch these people, and I never in my life dreamed that I would sit down and be able to talk to them.
Exactly. We had such a great time. I remember when Arnold Stang came to one of the, right?
Top Cat. Yeah. Yep.
And Arnold Stang's voice is still recognizable to people, because he had a very kind of nasally, kind of wimpy voice, but he did a ton of commercials and a ton of radio. It was really fun. Let me ask you about the golden age, if you will. Much like television and film, there were great shows, but there probably was a lot of schlocky stuff too, right, Kenny?
Oh, yeah. It's just like anything. I was exposed to mostly the good shows, so I never heard too much of the schlocky stuff, as you like to say. But there was some of it. I often think of how they would be able to do radio today with those people with all the modern equipment that they have. You know, using stereo equipment and hearing Matt Dillon walk from his office to the Long Branch Saloon and be able to tell whether he was going to the left or to the right to get there.
Well, I always remember you told this story once about Orson Welles and how busy he was when he was in his genius period around the early 40s, and they would take him from one network to another. He was so busy doing radio.
Right. They'd have a cab waiting for him downstairs at CBS to get him over to NBC to do something. And they would just give him the script, and that was it. He would do stuff. He didn't even do rehearsals. He'd just walk in, they'd hand him the script, and away we go.
Radio is still, to this day, despite all of the technological changes in the world, one of the more dominant mediums, whether it's radio on the internet, which is still radio, or radio over the air. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because of the immediacy. I think people are not lonely. I mean, you can't beat radio for talk shows. There used to be a saying when I was growing up, and it was called, when radio was king. Mm-hmm. In some areas, it still is. It is as far as talk. Not so much as far as sports, which is too bad because I'm a sports fan and I love sports radio. But as far as immediacy to get on the air and late at night or even during the day for talk shows, you can't beat it.
We talk a lot about the beauty of the human voice, the instrument that it is. And I'm going to get a little personal with you now. And it's no secret that you've been blind since birth.
Right.
And the auditory sense is so important to you. It's important to me, but it's even more important to a person without visual sense. So what is it about voices that attracts you? What attracts you to a voice?
Just the sound of it, the warmth of it, and that's basically about it.
The warmth, that's a very important factor, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. There are people that When I started talking about Bill Givens in Rochester, I heard that voice and I just fell in love with it. I wanted to meet this guy, and I eventually did.
You know, you talk about sports, and the story about meeting Vin Scully is a great one. Would you share that story?
Through Bill Givens, who got my parents and I tickets one day for Yankee Stadium right near the broadcast booth, we went to Yankee Stadium in 1966, and I mean, it was great. All the broadcasters came out of the broadcast booth and had to walk by our seats. So I was having a ball. And my dad said to me, hey, there's somebody who's walking with his head down, and I don't know who it is. Well, the guy opened his mouth, and I said to him, hey, that's Jerry Coleman. So being the bashful type that I am, I stood up and yelled out, hey, Jerry! Jerry came over and spent about 10 or 15 minutes with us and left tickets for my parents and I the next day. And this was 1966, and we were friends right up until his death. But as far as Vince Scully was concerned, the lady who was now my wife, Terry, who was not at that time, was taking courses from the University of Phoenix, and they were having a conference in San Diego. And she said to me, do you want to go? And at first I said, I don't think so.
Twist my arm, though.
And then she said, well, you know, one of the caveats is that we can go to a ball game at the ballpark. And I said, yeah, let's go. So we found out that they were going to be playing the Dodgers. And I called the Dodgers and I said, look, I know Vince Scully doesn't travel all the time. Will he go to San Diego? And they said, yeah, absolutely, he'll be there. So I called Jerry Coleman and I said, Jerry, you know, My girlfriend and I will be in San Diego such and such a weekend. You're going to be there because you're doing the Padres broadcast. Would it be possible to meet Vince Scully? And he said, Kenny, if Scully is here, you will meet him. So he told us how to get up to the broadcast booth. We did it, and Scully was there. He took us over and introduced us both to him. He could not have been nicer. He was just the most wonderful human being in the world. It's almost like meeting the President of the United States, or if God could talk, he would sound like that.
Well, I just I can't agree with you more because he's been a favorite of mine forever on the national scene. And when he retired this past World Series, the beautiful send-off, Kevin Costner's oration, everything about it was class. And he's loved. He's a beloved figure.
I heard his last broadcast, and Charlie Steiner, who is now the radio voice of the Dodgers, but who does the games and has been doing them since 2004, actually cried on the air.
Well, what's great about the Scully story is here he is all these years not needing or wanting to have anybody with him. He did both play-by-play and color at the same time, basically.
He did. He did a simulcast on radio and television for the first three innings of every game that he would broadcast, and then did the rest on television. Back in the days of the 50s and 60s and maybe 70s, broadcasters did the same thing. The Yankees had three radio announcers when they were home in New York. They had my hero, Mel Allen, and Phil Rizzuto, and Red Barber. And each one would do three innings on the air, but they would do it all by themselves. Mm-hmm. You didn't have a color man to comment on every pitch like you do today.
Those were and are great broadcasters to be able to do that and do it effortlessly. I mean, that's why they're in the Hall of Fame, so many of them.
I've gone back on YouTube and listened to some of Mel Allen's broadcasts. And I appreciated them then, but I appreciate them more even now, listening to them and listening to him work.
Let's go back again to some of the celebrity interviews and some of the interesting people you've had the pleasure of meeting. And again, that's one of the joys and gifts and blessings of being in this business. You get to touch base with people you've idolized. We've mentioned, dropped a few names, obviously. You and I mean, I look at the list of celebrity interviews, and it's, for me, it's a mile long. Yours must be 10 miles long. So let's talk about a few others. Who stands out?
I'll tell you two of them.
Okay.
Raymond Burr and Connie Francis.
Okay, let's start with Raymond Burr. Perry Mason, of course.
Right, and Ironside.
Ironside and Godzilla and all those things.
I had heard for a long time that Raymond Burr would not do interviews because I admired Raymond Burr the first time I ever heard that voice. And then I saw him on Good Morning America one day, and I said, well, if he can do Good Morning America, he can do my program. So I got in touch eventually with a lady who was his agent or screener or whatever. And every time I'd call her, she'd say, look, he's doing this, he's doing that. And finally I said to her, look, just tell me if he's interested, fine. If not, tell me that, and I'll just go away, and you'll never hear from me again. She said, okay, he's going to be at the Algonquin Hotel tonight in New York City. So I called the hotel and left a message. I said, listen, tell him to call me collect. So the phone rang about 9 o'clock, and I picked it up, and this voice said, Ken Meyer? And I said, Ray Burr? And he said, you recognized my voice? And I said, are you kidding? So we talked for a good half hour. And he said he'd be happy to do an interview. And I said, listen, do you ever come to Boston? And he said, yeah, I'm going to be up there to do some. He was doing commercials for some insurance company. I don't remember now which one it was. And I said, then I want to wait until you come to Boston because I want to really sit down and examine Perry Mason's psyche and what made Perry Mason tick. So a couple weeks later, the publicist called me and he said, okay, press conferences at noon, wherever it was. And she said, after that, you can interview him at his hotel. She said, he won't come to the studio. He does not like crowds. And I said, okay, whatever Perry Mason wants, Perry Mason gets. So I did an interview with him at the Marriott Long Wharf Hotel, and he was absolutely wonderful. I just sat there mesmerized, holding the microphone and asking him questions, and he was wonderful. I put together a montage of some of his memorable courtroom scenes from the Perry Mason show, and he said to me after he heard them, he said, you know what? He said, that's the first time I've ever heard any of those. He said, I never watched myself on television. And he said, that's the first time. And he said, I talked fast in those days.
you really impressed him. Wow.
And that's when he told me that they were going to start filming two-hour Perry Mason
shows. Which would have been, late 80s maybe?
84.
Okay.
85.
Yeah, I remember those movies. They were very successful.
They were very good.
You mentioned Connie Francis. Before you tell your story, I remember her comeback after the tragic, horrible story about her being raped, in a hotel room somewhere. And I saw her at the South Shore Music Circus, met her backstage. I did a phone interview with her as well, but I found her to be charming and lovely and a little on the fragile side. So tell me about your Connie Francis experience.
First time I ever saw her, she was making her comeback, and she was at Chateau Deville in Framingham. So I went backstage after the show, met her after the performance, and we instantly became friends. And came to South Shore Music Circus. I met her again, and she was gonna write a book. And she said to me, "What do you think I should call the book?" And I said, "Well, I would call it Among My Souvenirs." Well, Dick Clark told her she should call it Who's Sorry Now, and she took his advice instead of mine. But what do I know?
Exactly.
So she came to Boston to promote the book. She then asked me if I would be willing to help her co-host a telethon in Las Vegas. And I said, Connie, anything for you. I would love to do it. Because right in the middle of the interview, when we were doing her book, all of a sudden she said, "How did you get this book read?" And I was a little taken aback because I've never had anybody ask me that.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her, I said, "Well, my dad read it." And she said, how long did it take?" And I told her, and she said that she was just overwhelmed by that.
First of all, I got to drop in another personal note here that I met your parents at a 50th wedding anniversary, right?
Right.
And you asked me, at the time I was a local DJ, and you asked me to be the MC.
Yep.
Lovely people. But what a nice thing for a father to do. He actually read the book aloud to you.
Oh, yeah. He would read it on tape. And it was funny because I could always tell if he liked the book or not.
Yeah.
Because I could call him and I'd say, "How's the Jack Benny book?" And he'd say, it's okay, you know. But if I called him up and I'd say, how's the book on the burning bed? Oh, my God, I'm on page so-and-so, and this guy did this and this and this.
Right, right.
And
let me ask you, just to bring it to the present, we're talking about books. How do you read now? How do you get material?
I download books from a website called BARD, which is the Braille Audio Reading Department.
B-A-R-D,
BARD. B-A-R-D, yep.
Okay, great.
And I never thought I'd see this technology. I can download books onto an iPhone and be able to read them through a Bluetooth speaker. And I just love it.
You're one of the most voracious readers I know. Kenny reads everything.
I like to.
No, I know you read, but you said something earlier about the interview process, and it's so key to be prepared. And when you have a guest, as you've had dozens, hundreds, whatever, you want them to feel as though they're appreciated. What is the best thing you can do? It's to show them that you have done the homework and you've spent enough time, you're interested in them.
And they can tell.
Oh, well, they can always tell.
Exactly. They know if you've read the book or not. I interviewed Eddie Fisher, a great singer from the 50s.
I remember.
And we got into the studio late because, believe it or not, the program called BZ Countryside had gotten in late, so everything was running behind schedule. And Fisher could only do about 25 minutes. And he wanted to, he had to go to Toronto from Boston, and he wanted his agent or his manager or whatever to cancel the trip. He said, "Look, this guy actually read the book." He said, "I'd rather stay here and talk to him." And he said, "Well, you know, unfortunately, we can't do it." So they know, and they're very flattered by the fact that you take the time to read the book or find out something about.
Well, you can ask questions that pertain to the subject matter with more deference and definition. It just makes so much sense. But there are so many lazy people out there who don't do it and just phone it in, as they say.
Yeah, but exactly.
That's the fun of it. So if I were to ask you to cast a spell and wave the magic wand and open up the genie's lamp and ask for that one broadcast wish, maybe a one that got away or something you would have liked to have done. It's never too late, by the way, but what would it be?
Oh, boy. if I could interview anybody, Perry Como is one that I would love to have interviewed. Liberace is another one that I would love to have interviewed. Frank Sinatra, of course.
What about Jack Benny?
We got him on the air, but I didn't do the interview. Mm-hmm. Larry Glick did it. Benny was in Las Vegas, and every time we'd call the hotel, they would say, well, he's taking a nap, or he's getting his makeup on. And then one night, he actually picked up the phone. And of course, I recognized his voice right away. And I said,
hello.
Hello. And I said, Jack? And he said, yeah. And I said, have you got 5 minutes to talk to Larry Glick? And he said, no. And I said, have you got 2 minutes to talk to Larry Glick? And he said, yeah. So of course, I didn't even use the talk back. I just yelled from the control room. And I said, Larry, we got Jack Benny. And he went on the air, and he talked to Larry Glick.
Did he go more than two?
Yeah. He went about maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But I did get to meet and interview Don Wilson and Dennis Day.
Oh, Dennis Day. I met him as well, but didn't interview him. Lovely guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Very,
right.
Very talented. I think, for my money, one of the best Irish tenors. He could put Enrico Caruso and John McCormick to shame. He came here in 1980. Doing something called the Big Broadcast of 1944.
And I was at that show, and I can tell you Don Wilson was on the stage.
Yep.
The Ink Spots.
Yeah, exactly.
Hildegard.
Yep.
Right?
Right, exactly, yes.
I remember. And we had dinner, certain group of us had dinner, and Dennis Day was there, which was really fun, too.
Oh, yeah. He was a wonderful, wonderful
yes,
man.
Yes, lovely man.
I thank God for being able to have met. Again, these are people that you grow up with and listen to. And, you know, that's all I could think of is, my God, I'm sitting here, you know, talking to these people.
Well, one of the things before we close out is I keep coming back to your sense of enthusiasm and joy. And I mentioned this in the introduction, but you were inducted into the Massachusetts Broadcast Hall of Fame. And I know, because you cried into my shoulder, and I still can't get the stain out, I know how much that meant to you, but to be applauded by your peers, to be recognized by your peers, was a pretty exciting time for you. I know it was.
There is nothing like it. It's one thing to be recognized and admired by fans, but by your fellow workers, as it were, in the business, people that you have watched and people that you listen to who were there, that is something that is irreplaceable. And I will never, ever forget.
Well, you leave an impact, not just you, but those who do what we do. There's a legacy that's very long-lasting. They say that the radio waves that we emit are still traveling to planets well beyond our solar system, Kenny. So I'm assuming that somewhere out there, some alien life force is listening to you from 1985.
Yeah, could be.
Or Glick from 72, or you and me from 99, or whatever.
I remember one day I was in the radio station, and a young lady from the promotion department came in, and she said, Kenny, we got a tape here that somebody sent, and I can't identify the voice. And I can you listen to it? I said, sure. It turned out that the tape was me on the air. Somebody in Greece had picked up the broadcast, my broadcast.
Oh, my goodness.
And taped it and sent it to the radio station. And, man.
Did you recognize your own voice immediately?
Oh, absolutely.
Because sometimes I hear things that I did and recorded 3 years ago, and I honestly don't know it's me.
Yep.
But it's weird, depending on the circumstance. Wow, that is really cool. And this is well before the internet, obviously.
Oh, way before the internet.
Well, here on this podcast, we have listeners in Europe, in Asia. It blows my mind. In South America, somehow, I don't speak Spanish, but I'm assuming they're picking it. But you have fans certainly throughout the country who have listened to you on BZ primarily over the years. And now, you know, you're doing your show called City Talk in Boston.
Right.
WBCA, a low-power station, 102.9 FM. And it's part of the Boston Neighborhood Network. Is that what they call it?
Right. BNN, yep.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, Kenny, great to see you, my friend.
Oh, always great to see you, Jordan.
And you will always be comfortable in front of a microphone,
always.
As you just proved once again. But Godspeed, and congratulations again on your recent nuptials.
You know what? I have never been happier. Terry is a wonderful girl, a great lady, and we're in a beautiful home outside of Boston,
mm-hmm.
and you and I both now are living the kind of life that people dream about.
Indeed. Know? Indeed. The stuff that dreams are made of. Kenny Meyer, a dear friend and a wonderful broadcaster, thanks for gracing us with your presence today, my good man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'll come back anytime.
Hey, you've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast produced and hosted by Chart Productions, and our website, where you can find out a whole lot more, is chartproductions.com. You can link to Apple and all other major launch pads there. And if you get a chance, go to chartproductions.com, write me a review on Apple to help spread the word. Hey, thanks for listening. Have a great day.